rush through this a little bit because I've had to close the windows to keep the smoke, the California fire smoke, out of my room. And now to record this, I turned off the fans. So if I don't melt before we get to the end of this, it will be a miracle. One thing, I know this show is still new, something that I've mentioned before, but I want to really clarify, or maybe not clarify, but I want to reiterate. I find rereading books extremely valuable. And the reason I'm reiterating that right now is because this book, Killing Yourself to Live, 85% of a True Story by Chuck Klosterman, is a book I've read before. I read it about, I think, 9 years ago. And I can tell you when I started reading it again, I completely forgot about the whole main premise of the book, which is that he's traveling across the country, writing an article for Spin magazine, and he's visiting the sites of famous deaths in rock and roll. Great premise. Didn't remember that at all. I mean, obviously, once I started reading the book, I started remembering, but going in, didn't remember it. So if that's not an argument for the value of rereading books, then there really isn't an argument for rereading books. Because if you can forget the core premise of a book in 9 years, then that means reading a book once. It's not going to do it. It's not going to do it. At least not for books you value. And spoiler alert, I value this book. I loved it in 2011, and I loved it just as much this time. The interesting thing about the premise, though, which maybe excuses why I forgot it, is it's not really that important. It's important from a metaphorical perspective. Music is something, the best way I could describe this is Chuck Klosterman as the character. This is essentially a memoir, even though he would probably gag at me applying that word to this book. So in a way, since he says 85% of a true story, Chuck Klosterman in the book is Chuck Klosterman, the real Chuck Klosterman, but he's also maybe a character. Maybe, you know, when we write about ourselves, especially something like this that's funny, we exaggerate because it's fun. So Chuck Klosterman, the character, and I imagine Chuck Klosterman, the real life dude, is someone who knows a lot about music, popular music, old music, super indie, you've never heard of it music for most people. He's the guy that works and writes for a music magazine, but is also that guy that you know that reads all the music magazines, or that girl that you know that works at the record store and knows everything about all of the music in every genre across the store. I think we all know somebody like that. I know I do. And in some ways, I aspired to be that person for many years. If you ever saw the movie Blue in the Face with a whole bunch of people, it's there's a lot of famous people in that movie. It's Wayne Wang and Paul Auster, the novelist Paul Auster, and Wayne Wang made a movie together called Blue in the Face. They made two movies together, actually, Smoke and Blue in the Face. Blue in the Face, one of the people in there is Lou Reed. And one of the things that Lou Reed, or one of the things, what am I saying? The role that Lou Reed plays in that movie is basically a record store nerd. The guy that knows everything about all the records. That's, in a lot of ways, Chuck Klosterman. So with all of that knowledge in his head, and imagine him as a character. You're feeding all of this information to him as a character. That stuff's just going to come spewing out of him. Not as really the meaning of the book, because it's not really a book about music. The premise has to do with music, but it's not really a book about music. It's really a book about stumbling your way through your love life and using music as a metaphor to talk about it. Kind of like High Fidelity, the book, the movie, and the TV show, all of which are spectacular and completely different from each other. In fact, on the last page of this book, he has a conversation with his editor at the magazine and says, you know, like, what's happened on this trip? He's thinking about maybe I should put this into a book. And she says, why would you want to do that when everybody's just going to compare you to High Fidelity, like I just did? And that whole love thing. So I think the title, I actually think that the title is a mutation of some sort from something that happens in the book. So that I just mean the part of killing yourself to live, the main title, not the subtitle. There's a part where he's talking to this woman that he used to date. Actually, it's hard to describe some of the relationships in here because he has relationships with women that he doesn't actually date. There's a lot of ambiguity in the relationships. It's kind of the point of this whole stumbling through. And I can't remember if he was actually dating Q. But this woman he had a relationship with, Q, which I believe stands for Quincy. She says, or he says something to her about how he says, I spent a year killing myself trying to make you love me. And that automatically brought me back to that title, Killing Yourself to Live, Killing Yourself to Love. I spent a year killing myself, trying to make you love me, Killing Yourself to Love. But that sounds like a crappy title. So Killing Yourself to Live, I could see how that title would come out of that. I'm completely speculating. But the wording between those two things, I couldn't not connect them. That kind of thing would happen in a book like this, I think. The writing in this book is just, it's witty and it's snarky and it's super referential. And what I mean by referential is he's always mentioning stuff like bands, and not just bands, but pop culture stuff, but focused mostly on music. But there's other pop cultural stuff, but it's all kind of around Generation X, which is my generation, Klosterman's generation, I believe, at least from the references he makes. And when I was reading it this time, what I was wondering, because so many of the references, like Pavement, Eddie Rabbit, which was a guy from the 80s, I remember when I was a little kid, when I'm using air quotes right now, my first dance, my first, you know, like, hey, look at me, I can dance. I was probably like 3 years old, was to Eddie Rabbit. It was a popular song in like 1979, 1980 or whatever, called I Love a Rainy Night. And Interpol, some people might get that. That's more of an indie reference, but it's not necessarily a Gen X reference. They're a newer band compared to the other stuff that he's referencing. Family Ties, the TV show from the 80s. Tesla. No, not the scientist. No, not the car company. Tesla, the band. Did you know there was a band called Tesla? If not, you might not get some of the references that Klosterman makes in this book. And that's one of the things I wondered when I was reading this book. As a Gen Xer, it's totally in my wheelhouse. I'm getting all of the references. Because I, like I said, was a music nerd too. So I got all of that stuff. But I wonder if the generation before, like boomers, when they read this book, do they get all that stuff? Or the generation after, the millennials, are they getting all the same stuff out of it I am? Or is this really just, I don't want to say it's just a book for Gen Xers, but it's a book that seems like it's made specifically with the knowledge that Gen Xers are going to get the most out of it because they'll catch those references. In fact, in some ways, I would put it in the same bucket as Family Guy. Maybe I haven't watched any of the new seasons of Family Guy in a while. But I know that the first like five seasons were full of stuff that I got because of my age, because there were so many 80s TV references and stuff like that. And I would also put it in the bucket with the TV show Psych. A lot of 80s pop cultural referential humor. And I wonder when people that are not of my age group watch or read these things, if they get the same depth out of it. I'm not saying that it's trying to go deep in the sense of emotionally or intellectually deep. Not to say that there isn't that here. But when I say that if they go as deep as in if they get the references as deep, you know, are they digging, you know, like, are they laughing as hard? For example, Psych. My mom likes that show. I know she doesn't get a lot of the pop cultural references. So there are jokes in there that are just going past her. Maybe she's laughing because the actors are very good and they're very funny, but she might not get, you know, some 80s, you know, Flock of Seagull joke because she didn't know who Flock of Seagulls was. And when I was reading that and I was thinking about all these things, I started to wonder, I'm like, you know, like, one of my favorite authors, the first writer that I read that I felt like was uniquely my own in the sense that I didn't get it from school. I didn't get it from my family. I didn't get it from other friends. Other friends weren't reading it. It was purely my own. Something I discovered purely on my own was Kurt Vonnegut. And I wonder if I'm just skipping across the surface of his books because we are such different generations. If there are things in there that I'm not getting. Now, granted, Kurt Vonnegut's not as referential as the things that I mentioned, Family Guy, Psych, and this book, Killing Yourself to Live. The writing in this book, that I guess the reason I worry about that or I wonder about that is because I feel like the writing of this book is so tied with you being able to get those things. But the writing is just, it's spectacular in the sense that it's so real and so genuine. There, he has bumps, he has quirks, he has flaws, he's goofy, and he shows himself being an idiot. I'll get to that in a bit. But what he does in here too is, honestly, I didn't remember this either, but when I read it, I kind of put the book down for a second and just kind of absorbed how well he had been able to put into what is essentially a paragraph and a half, how he was able to exemplify cocaine in a way that I've never heard anyone describe it. Kind of like what I said about him, the rough edges and the, you know, like the truth of things. And I don't really, when I do these episodes, I don't want to be quoting stuff a lot. Number one, because I don't feel like if you know, throwing too many quotes out, it's like kind of a disservice to the author. Like, just go read the book, you know? But also it's boring to just listen to me read, I think. I don't know. I'm just going to do what I would want if I was listening to this podcast. But I feel like if I'm going to talk about what kind of, you know, the referentialness, I don't know if the referentialness will necessarily come out in this passage, but I'm talking about the way he writes. Maybe this will help you get an example of it. And this is, I think it shows his sense of humor, but also shows his intelligence. So here we go. Oh, a little backstory. We're starting, this part is starting in the flashback. And the flashback is the first time he did cocaine. He's not a cocaine person, he says. You'll hear that in here. But this is the first time he did it. I then dipped my apartment key into a tiny plastic bag, which drew a nice little nipple of white powder and sucked it through my right nostril. Seconds later, I had two wholly new thoughts. A, this is actually no big deal. And B, I feel perfect. There's no question in my mind that the dangers of cocaine had been wildly exaggerated by the anti-drug lobby. Oh, I'm sure it's not good for you, but you can certainly enjoy it recreationally, assuming you have disposable income and you hate yourself. Unlike pot or mushrooms or liquid Vicodin, it doesn't really shift reality. It just makes reality louder, brighter, and more interested in the availability of fashionable footwear. It makes you feel like you're walking on the street, minding your own business, and the smartest, most attractive person you've ever met suddenly jumps out from behind a bush and gives you a compliment. This sensation lasts between 16 and 21 minutes, after which you become singularly obsessed with finding more cocaine. That desire forces you to enter cocaine culture, at least for one night. Cocaine culture contains the worst of everything, the worst conversations, the worst friendships, and the worst kind of unspeakable joy. But the instant you've received a powdery compliment from this imaginary stranger, entering cocaine culture becomes the goal of your entire evening. People who want cocaine will lie about anything. People will surrender integrity they never had to begin with. To get free cocaine, women will have sex with men they normally wouldn't dance with. Cocaine makes you more popular, but also less likable. Cocaine makes you feel guilty in advance. When you snort cocaine, you consciously allow yourself to become foolish in the hope of seeming cool. And that's the worst choice any smart person can make. This is why I'm not a cocaine person. This is why I will probably never become a cocaine person. That said, I'm currently snorting cocaine in a Ford pickup truck at 5:45 p.m. with a man I met 20 minutes ago. And I am doing this because, somehow, it seems reasonable. So I think that gives you pretty good feel for his sense of humor. And yeah, I think that's a pretty good passage. If you've ever experienced cocaine culture, he nailed it in one paragraph. So take the drug references. He smokes pot a bunch of times in the book. You take the drug references. You take his style of writing. You could say he's a touch of Hunter S. Thompson. But he's not. You know, Hunter S. Thompson was always about, to some degree, about either himself, if you're looking at especially Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, about himself losing control, or about things around him kind of losing or falling into chaos. Klosterman's not so much that. He's very controlled. He's a nerdier guy. He's not self-destructive, at least not in this book and not overtly. He's just kind of, he's a lot more like the main character in High Fidelity, whose name is completely slipping from my mind right now. He's just more of that kind of person. In fact, if I were to compare Klosterman to anybody, I would probably say Lester Bangs. He was like the punk rock music critic. And not only because he was writing about punk rock, not solely, but he was writing in the era of punk rock. He was in New York hanging out at like CBGB's and Max's Kansas City. But also kind of his aesthetic, the aesthetic of his writing was punk rock in the way that I would compare Klosterman to him. In the, it's a little outsider. And it's not a mainstream ethos. You know, like, I'm into this. You might not be. For example, for Lester Bangs, it was into loving garage rock. And garage rock, really at the time, from what I gather, wasn't considered serious music. It was kind of considered trash. Because, you know, it was these, the recordings were cheap and the, you know, the musicians weren't the best, most virtuosic musicians. But, like, he wrote about it like it was art. And when you read Lester Bangs write about, you know, like Louie, or that kind of garage rock, I can't, my brain is not pulling up. If you can find Nuggets, which was a compilation album of garage rock, if you can find that, then you'll understand the music I'm talking about. But he wrote about it in a way that makes you see something in it that you wouldn't have seen before. That's a, to me, that's like what the best critics do. Which is funny because we use the word critic like, well, a critic is somebody who shits on something, right? But these people, when they are their best, these men and women at their best, they make us see something that we would have missed. That's the, I feel like that's really their role. You know, it's like you saw that movie, it was all right. But did you think about this? And did you know about this? Rewatch it thinking about this. And then all of a sudden you see, you know, like you watch Citizen Kane and you're like, man, that movie was fucking boring. And then you read Roger Ebert talking about Citizen Kane or somebody great like that. Somebody who saw things like Roger Ebert did when it came to film. And you read it and you go, man, that movie sounds awesome. Sure, that's the same movie I watched. And then you watch it and all of a sudden you go, oh. That to me, that's a critic. And Lester Bangs was a master of that. And I feel like, to a certain degree, I haven't read a lot of his music writing, but just the parts in here where he's talking about albums, I see that in him. You know, like I said, Lester Bangs, it was about garage rock. Well, for Klosterman, one, an example of him seeing something that's maybe outsider, non-mainstream, is he loves Kiss. And Kiss, I don't know about in the 70s, but since the 70s, it's been tragically unhip to like Kiss. But he loves Kiss. And this is probably the only book you will ever read that uses not only Kiss, but the four solo albums by the members of Kiss as a key metaphor in the book. In fact, this is probably the only book you will read ever that will acknowledge that the four Kiss solo albums even exist. One other thing he does in here that's, speaking of like that critic and making you see something differently, he gives a really a great retcon interpretation of Radiohead's Kid A. What I mean by retcon is a retro continuity is what that's an abbreviation for. Essentially, it's like rewriting the past to fit the understanding of the future or the present. Sorry, not the future. You see it with TV shows a lot. This character suddenly, you know, they weren't written to be gay. Now they're gay. Well, then they have flashbacks that make it look like they always were. It just was like it was never mentioned before. That's called retconning. So it's a, there's a lot of other ways. That's a, probably a tactful way that it's done and a possibly artistic way that it's done. A lot of times it's done really tacky. A lot of times it's done because a producer says this is the way it's going to be, and the writers are like, that's not the way it was supposed to be. Too bad, fix it. So retcon in the context I'm using it, in the artful sense, is looking at something with present eyes, looking at something from the past and present eyes. And he does that with Kid A. Kid A came out before the events of 9/11, but he talks about what if, you know, like almost like imaginary, like listen to the album imagining that Thom Yorke predicted the events of 9/11. And then he gives you like a song by song breakdown, not the full songs, but like this song means this. And at this point, this is happening. You know, this isn't really happening as a reference to like the unreality of what's going on. It makes you look at that album in a very different way, even though, once again, retconned, Thom Yorke had none of that in mind because he couldn't. It hadn't happened yet. In fact, Thom Yorke used the cut-up technique to write the lyrics for Kid A, which is mixing together random things. You know, actually, another thing about music, before we move on past music, I didn't realize when I was reading this book, another thing you should know about me. I am a heavy note taker. I always write things down. One of the things I've always done, I think, is because we moved around a lot when I was a kid, and I was kind of always the outsider because I was always, I wasn't around enough to really be current on, you know, if you're moving from city to city. This is different now that you guys have the internet, I'm sure. To some degree, this is different. But when I was growing up, you move from place to place, different things were popular in different places. So you're always kind of playing catch up if you moved a lot or you moved schools a lot. I always felt like outside. I didn't understand what people were into. So I started to obsessively like write things down, like what's that movie? What's this album? What's this? I'd write those things down and then go find out what they were because I felt like I had to educate myself. And that part of me, I'm pretty sure, was very active when I read this book in 2011 because I saw references to music that I probably had never heard of before. A lot of the stuff in here I'd heard of before, but five examples that I found that I'm guessing at the time I didn't hear of and probably found out who these musicians were through this book were Boards of Canada, Drive-By Truckers, Kings of Leon, Superchunk. Okay, that's four. I count poorly. There's four examples. Let's drink some water here. Another thing, small thing. Actually, this is more about the real Chuck Klosterman. It pops up in small places in the book. But not only is he a music nerd, but he's a basketball nerd. He loves basketball. And I just bring that up because I find it ironic that I listened to the audiobook of this. I didn't actually even read it with my eyeballs. I listened to the audiobook of this. And when I was listening to the audiobook of this, ESPN was muted in the background. I just found that pretty funny. I didn't realize till about an hour into it. Although I wasn't watching basketball. I was watching baseball. Not that it matters, but I guess you can't be honest. So I said this book is about dating, about love, essentially. Although I'm hesitant to use the word love because it's really, it's not what we would, it's relationships. Maybe that's a better way to say it. It's about his relationships with women, in particular, to some degree, I think he doesn't go into who the women are too deeply. Probably because they're based on real people. He didn't want to give too much information. But from what I can tell, some of them at least were, I'm going to use the air quotes here, damaged women. And what I mean by that is there's a specific type of male, at least there used to be, who is drawn to date women that are either just recently out of a relationship or they're not in a place to want a serious relationship. And they're not drawn to these women for malicious purposes. I think, in all honesty, they're drawn to them because they themselves, the men themselves, are damaged and don't want to be vulnerable. So they want to date someone who maybe it can't completely work out with, so that, like, they can just, I don't know. I was like this for most of my 20s. So that's part of the reason I'm struggling with wording this. Is there's no security in, you know, you're completely insecure. So there's a part of you, you're not consciously doing this, that's drawn to women that maybe at the time that you know them are incapable of loving you. And he has a quote. And the reason I say that he might be doing that is he has a quote in here where he meets this woman and he says, I think she's just broken up with someone and she's still sad. You know, like, there's, you can just see, like, that's, you know, maybe she's probably not just sitting there crying, but she just looks in the dumps. And he says, I tend to equate sadness with intelligence. And I think what he means there with intelligence is not, I don't think he actually means intelligence. I think he means that, like, they're interesting. He sees sad women and all of a sudden they're interesting. I think that interesting, that connection between them being interesting in some ways is connected to this whole idea of what we would call the artistic temperament, right? Not that he's looking at this woman and thinking, ah, she must be an artist. But when we talk about artists, we talk about, you know, suffer for your art. And I think in some way that transitions here, that there's, he's seen a depth. Not to say that these women don't have any depth. He's seen a different depth in them that isn't there, but he's seen it because of the sadness. I guess maybe a way to say that is looking at somebody who's sad and thinking, oh, they're tortured. Sometimes you can just be sad. It doesn't mean there's, like, some existential depth of that sadness. It's just you're sad. So there's this association here. And I think that the reason I went through it, the reason Klosterman goes through it, this confusing of sadness with, he says intelligence, I say interesting, is because of that artistic temperament association. And because as music nerds and, you know, people who have all of this trivia, also I'll call it hip trivia, you know, it's not necessarily mainstream trivia, floating around in your head, there's a big emphasis on artistic temperament in the men that feel this way towards these women. So they associate this artistic temperament with, we all associate artistic temperament to some degree with anguish. And when we do that, we soon start to associate the reverse. He looks across the room and he goes, oh, she's wounded. She's so interesting. She's so real. So cool. Now, those aren't quotes from his book. I'm just exemplifying, like, that thought process. Let's see the leaps of logic going on there. And that leads to infatuation with people, like I said, that are incapable of loving you. Someone who's just got out of a relationship that's sad, not really looking for somebody at that moment. But that's that insecurity. Like, it's like you're covering your base. Well, didn't work out. Well, it wasn't, you know, it's not that there's something wrong with me. It's just, it was the wrong timing. You know, like, not that you would necessarily blame it on the woman, but you would blame it on the situation. Oh, you know, well, she had just got out of a relationship. She just wasn't ready, which is true. But there is still that part of you that you're not dealing with, which is being drawn to that. In fact, he has an imaginary conversation. And I don't mean it's a book. I don't mean that he makes it up in the sense that he presents it as real. I mean, he says, he imagines he's having a conversation with Q. He's like, she might say this and I might say this. And one of the things that she might say is that Chuck makes her feel like a character at times. That he's just fitting different women into a script that always stars him in the same role. And that's another symptom of this whole thing that I'm talking about, because it's the repetitiveness. And that comes from that insecurity too. That repetitiveness. Oh, I went through this with this woman and it ended up the same way as it did with the last woman. Why? Because you made the same mistake and you did the same things. And that's really at the heart of it, what this book's about. Sure, the situation is he's driving across the country for spin, going to places where famous musicians died. He's talking a lot about music, but it's really about like these women. And there's three in particular in the book that he's trying to resolve feelings about. It's a very, now that I talk about it, there's a lot more depth in this book that one might think from picking it up, assuming that it's just a book about traveling across the country to look at famous, you know, that's the kind of book that somebody would tell you to write. Like, hey, you know, just write about the famous deaths in rock. You know, it's like a listicle book. You'll get on the charts on Amazon with that one. Yeah, you'll bring home some cash. All right, one other thing I want to say about this book. There are, of all the things in this book that I remember the most, are the stories of the stupid lies that he tells. Remember I told you earlier he shows himself being a fool? There are times in here where he tells people lies and they're just, he's awful. He's awful at lying. And I remember, not the first one I'm going to share with you, but the second one, I remember this one. This is what I remember most about this book. And when I read it this time, I snorted. I was listening. I wasn't reading. But when I heard it, I snorted. It made me laugh just as much this time as I'm sure it did the first time. So the first story. In the first story, him and I think it's Q are in their apartment and they're going to smoke pot. And they find out that something's wrong with their lighter. Trust me, I'm going to tell you these stories, but the way I tell it is not as good as the way he tells it. So you definitely want to read the real versions of these. But they realize that something's wrong with the lighter. So I think Q tells him, you know, go next door and ask the neighbor if we can borrow a lighter. So yeah, they want a lighter so they can smoke a bowl. So he goes next door and he knocks on the neighbor's door and he gives him this kind of spiel. And basically he asks this guy, he's like, can I borrow a lighter? Because he's not going to tell the truth. Like, can I borrow a lighter? Because my girlfriend and I want to smoke pot and our lighter died. Instead, what he tells him is, he says, we're having a party later. And a bunch of people are coming over and they're all smokers. So I want to have a lighter. And the guy's like, well, aren't they, if they're smokers, wouldn't they bring their own lighters? And he says, well, this is the way he saves himself from that, is he says, well, we also have a lot of candles. And the guy gives him a lighter, you know, like, whatever, keep the lighter. And he goes back and he tells Q what happened. She's like, so you're telling me you told the guy that we're having a party. There's a bunch of people coming over here who are completely short-sighted that bring cigarettes but don't bring lighters. And it's a big party and you need his lighter, but you're not going to invite him to the parties. And also, there's going to be a lot of burning candles all over the place. It's just, I don't know if I'm doing it justice, but just remembering it and talking about it makes me laugh. But the one that really got me, the one that made me snort. So he's in a hotel room and I don't remember where the hell he is. And he's figures out he's, once again, lighter problem. Doesn't have a lighter. He's got some shake. He doesn't even have like a full bowl. And he remembers like you can use a car lighter. You know, you can like push the car lighter in. If you can, some people listen to this might not even know what a car lighter is. It's this thing that you used to push in. It was like coiled metal. It would be built into cars when they thought that everybody smoked in their cars, which I'm sure they did. You'd push this thing in and it would complete an electrical circuit and it would heat the metal coil. And then you would pull it out and you'd light a cigarette with that. So it wasn't actually a flame. But he had heard that, you know, you could do that. And then you just sprinkle your shake on top of that hot coil. And then you can smoke that way. So he does. And he gets super stoned. And he goes into this hotel and he checks in. And while he's checking in, there's this kid with a, like a teenager, not like, is a teenager, with a suitcase. And he notices when he goes in the hallway, this kid opens a side door and a bunch of other kids come in. And they're all, he says, they're all saying the same thing. We're so going to party. Not, you know, we're going to get drunk. We're going to get wasted. They're all saying the same thing. We're so going to party. We're so going to party. So I don't know if they're next door to him or whatever, but he's still super stoned and he goes and checks into his room. And then he goes over to like the ice machine and he runs into one of the teenage girls and he has this really weird conversation with her where he just says stupid stuff and he starts talking about just random things and then finally breaks away from her. He goes back into his room and then a few minutes later, there's a knock on the door and he goes and it's the girl. And now he's like, what is going on? You know, he's like starting to get a little paranoid. He opens the door and she's like, basically she asks him, she's like, are you stoned? And he's like, no, of course not. Of course I'm not. And she's like, oh, because we wanted to buy some pot from you. And then he feels bad that like he's told her a lie. So then he tells her, he's like, no, you're right. You're right. I am stoned. But now remember, he's on a road trip by himself. There's nobody else there. He doesn't want to sell a teenager drugs, which is pretty smart. But instead of just saying that, he feels bad. And this is the lie he comes up with. He says, I do have pot. You're right. But I can't sell it to you because it's my girlfriend. She's at the store. And if she comes back and finds out that I sold some of her pot, she's going to be really mad. It's just like the worst lie ever. So that's about it for this book. It's a transition from like me laughing to like ending this. But let's see, how long have we gone? 43 minutes. Wow. I never expected this show to be 43-minute episodes, which I think the last one was about the same. I really thought sometimes these were going to be like 2 to 10-minute episodes. I have a lot to say about these books. No guarantee it'll always be like that. If you are enjoying these, please rate and review in whatever app that you are listening to this in that allows you to rate and review and share it with some book lovers because it's the only way I'm going to get people to find out about these episodes and this show in general. So I guess we will come back when I finish another book. Until then, watch out for mastodons.